You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jill Ryan, and I'm here on behalf of the Commonwealth in this appeal of a sexually violent predator case. I would like to reserve about 5 minutes for rebuttal. This case arises out of the Commonwealth's appeal in the sexually violent predator case, where the trial court granted Mr. Gibbons the motion to dismiss the sexually violent predator petition that was pending before him. And we've alleged 3 assignments of error that this court has granted. The case revolves around the statute 37.2-905.1, which is a substantial compliance statute in the Sexually Violent Predator Act. The trial court erred in failing to apply that code section in granting Mr. Gibbons' motion to dismiss without first finding that the Commonwealth, in fact, failed to follow the provisions of Virginia Code Section 37.2-93, 37.2-94, or 37.2-95. The trial court also erred in failing to apply that code section and granted the motion to dismiss without finding that any such failure was a result of gross negligence or willful misconduct. And finally, the trial court erred in failing to apply that code section when it shifted the burden to the Commonwealth to prove that the Commonwealth actually complied with the provisions of 37.2-903, the screening provisions of the Sexually Violent Predator Act, instead of requiring Mr. Gibbons as the respondent to overcome the presumption of substantial compliance within that code section.
So actually, there's a presumption of compliance, isn't there?
I'm sorry, Your
Honor? There's a presumption of compliance.
Yes, there is.
And the only aspect of that statute that might suggest something different was absent a showing of failure to follow these provisions as a result of gross negligence or willful misconduct. Now, presumably, if that becomes operative, it's because the respondent in the case has the burden of showing that.
Yes, the respondent does have the burden of showing that aspect. And that's similar to what this court has found, and the court has addressed this statute in 2 other cases, Harris versus Commonwealth and Warrington versus Commonwealth. And in both of those cases, the trial court's decision was upheld because the respondents in those cases did not make that requisite showing. And what we're arguing here today on the converse, obviously, is that this court should reverse the trial court's decision in this matter. As a background, 37.2-90 is the screening mechanism that screens offenders as potential sexually violent predators. And the Department of Corrections screens using an actuarial risk assessment instrument, the Static 99. And offenders such as Mr. Gibbons, who receive a score of 5 or more, are then referred on to what's called the Commitment Review Committee for additional screening for full evaluation. The statute also gives the director discretion in certain cases where a score falls below that, but there are certain aggravating circumstances to move the offender forward. But in this case, the director, the Department of Corrections, scored Mr. Gidden as a 5 on the static 99. He was referred on to the Commitment Review Committee pursuant to 37.2-904, and then the case was forwarded to the Office of the Attorney General under 37.2-905. Ultimately, the Office of the Attorney General filed a petition to have Mr. Gibbons committed as a sexually violent predator. Mr. Gibbons filed a motion to dismiss, challenging that score, alleging that his score should have been a 4, and therefore he should have never come within the gambit of the SVP Act. The Commonwealth filed a written response to that motion, citing that governing statute, 37.2-905.1, and pointing out, in fact, that Mr. Gibbons had not, in his motion, made any allegations pursuant to that statute, or even made any argument. That statute, again, notes that 37.2-903, 904, and 905 are procedural and not jurisdictional. And then, quote, absent a showing of failure to follow these provisions as a result of gross negligence or willful misconduct, it shall be presumed there's been substantial compliance with these provisions. So as our argument, Mr. Gibbons needed to show that, in fact, there was a failure to follow the screening provisions, and that failure was as a result of gross negligence or willful misconduct.
Counsel, is it possible to read the court's comments on JA 90 and thereafter, as perhaps in the motion to reconsider, it did consider gross negligence and willful misconduct?
I don't believe it is. I think it's a stretch. And admittedly, we had a lot of extraneous arguments in the lower court, but the court was obviously very concerned about the fact that Mr. Giddens had been through a jury trial before, and was concerned basically finding the testimony of Mr. Giddens and his brother credible, and found that what his, I believe his, the court's words were, that the score or the form was wanting.
But it also talked about the attempts that Mr. Giddens had made to get someone's attention that perhaps this was a 4 instead of a 5. He said, I believe, the Commonwealth had an opportunity after notification by Mr. Goff to bring in additional information. So within those comments, is it possible to read any of that as a conclusion that there was gross negligence or willful misconduct? At a minimum, gross negligence.
Gross negligence, yes. Respectfully, I don't believe there is. I believe in the end what the court found, finding, and obviously the Commonwealth disagrees regarding the credibility of the witnesses and the evidence, but at best, what the court found was that there could have been a difference in scoring. Well, what was not ever shown was, well, attempts were made apparently by Mr. Giddens to reach someone in the Department of Corrections. There was not any testimony by Mr. Giddens as to what stage this was at. In other words, amounting to a failure to follow the provisions. Understandably, perhaps the trial court didn't like hearing that Mr. Giddens had tried to tell someone, hey, I've lived with someone for 2 years. But the court's comments were also found that, well, why wouldn't anyone make those comments? Why wouldn't anyone say that? I believe that's in the appendix at page 41 and again at page 63. So what we have is the Department of Corrections scoring, but no testimony as to whether at that point in time it was still within the gamut, first of all, the Department of Corrections to be able to correct its score, or whether the case had moved forward already to the Commitment Review Committee, and whether the Department of Corrections is in some way obligated to take testimony from a respondent that it's scoring, or to give greater weight to Mr. Giddens' testimony than to the official objective records that it relied on in scoring.
Could Mr. Giddens, in his motion to dismiss, ever assert or plead or allege in any way gross negligence or willful misconduct?
No, he did not. And that was part of what we had pointed out. And
so he walked in and just cited Shelton, and that was the end of it as far as he was concerned.
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor. And Shelton, of course, was decided in June of 2007, and 37.2-905.1 was enacted and became effective on July 1 of 2007.
Right, but the Commonwealth never expressed that at the trial court either.
Not directly. I would admit the Commonwealth never said, hey, that Shelton was either overruled or superseded by 37.2-905.1. But the Commonwealth did repeatedly point to the court to 37.2-905.1, to the idea of substantial compliance, and to the idea that, at best, if the court believed the credibility of the witnesses, then what we had is a simple difference of scoring, but not a failure to follow provisions, and not certainly not any gross negligence or willful misconduct.
So 905.1 was directly before the trial court, particularly in the motion to reconsider. And if you read 905.1 and you read Shelton, obviously 905.1 overrules it.
Yes. And the Commonwealth actually pointed it out in its initial response to the motion to dismiss, as well as the motion to reconsider. And in terms of, so on appeal for the first time, Mr. Giddens talks about 37.2-905.1, but instead of pointing to the record and argues that this court should uphold the court's findings, factual findings, and findings of law that support that. But the record is silent because the court never made any such findings. And we're asking, obviously, the court to reverse the trial court's decision and send the matter back for a full trial, but certainly not to adopt Mr. Ginn's position and find now retroactively that what the court found somehow met 905.1, when that was not expressly stated by the court.
You have gotten below your five-minute mark. You may use your time any way you'd like it.
If there are no further questions at this point, I will reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Josh Goff, here for Troy Giddens. The posture of this case, as is contained in the record, is that the Commonwealth filed this motion in December, or this petition in December of 2016. Prior to that time, the procedures that are outlined beginning in 372903 went into effect. Mr. Giddens testified, and the record contains, very early on, he realized that his static 99 score, the score that's prescribed in 903 to be used in these screening procedures, was incorrect. He testified that it had been scored incorrectly in the past.
Counsel, may I ask you this? Did you ever plead in your motion to dismiss gross negligence or willful misconduct?
The conduct contained in the motions constitutes gross negligence. I would submit I don't have, or Mr. Giddens doesn't have to use a buzzword of gross negligence. The facts or what constitutes.
He doesn't have to alert the court to the governing standard?
The trial court's presumed to know the law. That's well established. And Mr. Giddens outlined the reasons why the law had been violated in this case.
But it sounds like Shelton was a focal point, and it's essentially been overtaken by a legislative amendment. I mean, that was the argument below. Was Shelton supplied the rule of decision, right?
And we had another hearing in June. That was at the first hearing.
Okay.
Shelton was not a big topic of conversation at the second hearing. And the trial court was made aware of what the standard was at the second hearing. And as has been pointed out, referenced the governing standard. And that's contained in the joint appendix. But
meaning reference the statute.
Yes, Your Honor. But there's no requirement that buzzwords be used. There's a requirement that the record contain sufficient evidence to support whatever proposition needs to be supported. And in this case, the record says that Mr. Giddens was in the custody of the Department of Corrections. He is not entitled to an attorney prior to the petition being filed. He first alerted the SOSA unit that his static 99 score had been scored incorrectly. He then filed an institutional grievance with the Department of Corrections against it.
But does the Department of Correction have to accept his... I mean, it's one thing... I mean, it's something like a birth date or when an offense occurred or what the offense is. And those are objective facts, and that's that. But something like how you run facts through a particular scoring mechanism when there's other considerations at play, why is that their decision to not accept that gross negligence? Or willful misconduct.
They perhaps could choose to do that, but the record of this case, found to be credible by the trial court, they ignored Giddens. They did nothing to investigate what he's saying. So the Commonwealth makes a lot of 905.1 calling these things procedural, as if that doesn't matter. These procedures need to be done correctly. And at a minimum, Mr. Giddens is saying, he's not saying something outlandish. He's saying something that could very well be true, and they had a duty at least to investigate it. The Commonwealth had a duty to investigate it, and Mr. Giddens alerted the Attorney General's office themselves.
Can I interrupt you there, though? I think you put your finger on the nub of the problem. You said the Commonwealth has a duty to do the screening mechanism correctly. Your motion to dismiss makes the very point. It has to be correct, and your argument is it was not factually correct. But that's not what the statute says. The statute says you can have a failure to follow these provisions, a complete failure. In the absence of willful misconduct or gross negligence, it doesn't matter. And that was the whole point of reversing Shelton. This is just a screening mechanism. It has nothing to do with the ultimate merits of the case, and trial judges should not be wrapped around the axle about the Attorney General's prosecutorial discretion to bring these kind of claims. So it can't be what you're saying. Tell me why I'm wrong. It can't be that just being correct or incorrect is a standard.
Then why do them, then? I mean, if you're not, if you alert the people doing the test that this is incorrect, you provide credible evidence that it's incorrect.
Because they disagree with you. They disagree. And it's his call. It's the Attorney General's call whether to do it or not do it. And then the inmate, in this instance, has a right to challenge everything on the merits. But this is a screening mechanism. This is not the merits of the case.
There's nothing in the record that supports the contention that they disagreed with Mr. Giddens. The record supports the contention that they ignored him, that they went solely by the records and they ignored a living, breathing human being saying this is not correct, and they did nothing to investigate that. That is grossly negligent.
So it's grossly negligent to take an individual in this situation, convicted of this crime, subject to these static 99 scores, and say, you know, I hear what you're saying, but I don't agree with it. We're going forward and have this tested in court. That's grossly negligent.
It's grossly negligent to say that if the General Assembly requires a 5 and his actual score is a 4, that he alerts the people calculating the score to the fact that the score should have been a 4 for a specific reason, for them not to at least investigate that fact. The Commonwealth is not entitled to persist being wrong over a course of months or years saying the same thing just because the records say something is right. The trial court found that to be wrong. That factual determination is entitled to weight in this court. But at the very least, Mr. Giddens was entitled to have an investigation of what he was saying to see whether he even qualified.
I know this will sound shocking to you, but if I'm reading the statute correctly, the Commonwealth has a right to be wrong. The only thing they don't have a right to do is to be grossly negligent or to be willfully misconduct.
That's not shocking, Justice Kelsey. I agree with you. They have a right to be wrong. They don't have a right to be grossly wrong. They don't have a right to ignore the fact that they are called out being wrong.
But here's the problem. I mean, you know, here there's certainly some basis for your client, you know, complaining about the faulty scoring. In my experience, you know, inmates write all kinds of stuff, you know, all the time, complaining about all kinds of different things. And so, you know, it's not like there's nothing going on and then this, you know, well-written, coherent letter comes in and, oh, well, let's look into this. I mean, there's a whole lot of other things that they have to deal with. And so, I mean, do we have to devise a standard that says anytime they get some kind of correspondence, unless they jump on it and investigate the facts, I mean, there's habeas petitions, I mean, there's all kinds of things. It seems like a pretty tricky standard to foist on the government in light of all the things that they have to contend with.
Well, I certainly know that inmates file a variety of things.
Don't we all?
But in this particular instance, Mr. Giddens was not saying anything outlandish. He went by what the Static 99 assesses and said, this one point is incorrect. And he requested and testified at the trial court level that here's what I did to alert them to that fact. And he did that through various channels, starting with the SOSA unit, the people calculating the score. And at the very least, I agree. I would lose, Mr. Giddens would lose, if the SOSA unit said, we hear what you're saying, Mr. Giddens, but for these reasons, you're wrong. But they ignored him. The SOSA unit ignored him, the Department of Corrections ignored him, and the trial court, most importantly for this proceeding, the trial court took all of that evidence into account, and perhaps it could have been cleaner if the trial court just said, I find this to be grossly negligent, but the
trial court... Where did the trial court say that?
I said it...
It
would have been cleaner had they used the magic words, but they found gross negligence based on the totality of all of the evidence in both hearings, that the way this assessment was conducted with Mr. Giddens was grossly negligent because the Commonwealth had the opportunity to investigate this on multiple occasions and did not do so. There are no further questions. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Thank you. Again, to piggyback on a comment or an observation that Justice Kelsey made, while we don't at this point concede that the initial scoring was wrong, that's what the statute is for. If it's wrong, if it's a simple error, it doesn't rise to the level of gross negligence or willful misconduct. The case moves forward because, again, it's a screening instrument. And while Mr. Giddens may have brought it to the attention by his own testimony, it wasn't that he was ignored. He was eventually told through the grievance process that's a matter for the court. Again, the timing is not very well clear in the appendix, but the case moves through the Department of Corrections scoring onto the Commitment Review Committee and onto the Attorney General's office. It wasn't clear at what point Mr. Giddens engaged in that grievance process.
May I ask you, what is in the record in terms of, I mean, do we have like his letter or email or whatever that shows who and how he alerted?
That was not made. I know part of the appendix. I'm not sure if it was ever made part of the court file. We do have his testimony.
Because, in other words, what I'm thinking is, I mean, suppose I'm a government official and I get some profanity laced, whatever, and then there's a paragraph and they're saying, by the way, you're just dead wrong about how you figured out this score. Well, I'd probably put that in the round file versus, you know, something else. So I was just trying to figure out, you know, and that might go into whether the official was negligent or grossly negligent or whatever.
And I don't think we have that as clear in the record. What we do have, and they weren't subject of evidence, but they were subject of argument, was the fact that the Department of Corrections scored the actuarial instrument based on the records it had before it, which, and this was used to cross-examine Mr. Giddens, an admission he made in a prior sexually violent predator evaluation that he never lived with anyone for more than 2 years. And again, that was obviously subject to cross and argument, and ultimately the court weighed that differently. But that's the point that we're making, is the Department of Corrections scored this based on the records that it had, and it was not of the type of information, as Your Honor pointed out before, that is objectively easily seen as incorrect. There were multiple records.
And it was his brother who came in and said,
brother,
yes, he did live with me for 2 years.
Yes, and again, we had some arguments as to those time frames and that credibility. But ultimately, the court finding that to be credible, and the court finding that based on that testimony, maybe the score should have been a 4, we would argue at best, taken in the light most favorable to Mr. Giddens, showed a difference in score based on this additional information.
I don't know that this is going to be an issue in resolving the case, but if I ask you about it, in case it turns out it will. They're not buzzwords in certain circumstances where there's immunity, for example, from liability for ordinary negligence. A person has to plead gross negligence, particularly when it's a governmental agency. This is a governmental entity here as well. Is it the Attorney General's position that this is a pleading requirement for the respondent, or does the Attorney General take the position that it's not pleading, but at the very least they have to raise it and put the court on notice that it is an issue in the case? What is your position?
I would say the latter. At the very least, they have to put the court on notice of it. But even in the facts of this case, the Commonwealth put the court on notice and the respondent on notice, and the Commonwealth was the only one who really talked about the standard, either the first motion to dismiss and the motion for reconsideration. So even when put clearly on notice by the Commonwealth, the standard wasn't adopted or argued, and there was no evidence regarding that standard. Ultimately, the evidence before the court was the score could have been a 4 if you listened to and found this testimony to be credible. And that's the Commonwealth's position. That is not a failure to follow any of those screening provisions, and that's certainly not gross negligence for Wilkins.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Call the next case.